Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spungin. Before we get started on today's episode, a special welcome to our new listeners in the United Arab Emirates. Hundreds of you downloaded last week's episode, and we're delighted to have you with us. And if you are in the UAE, drop me a line, and I'll see what I can do about getting you a special normalization discount on a subscription to haaretz.com. Today's show will also touch on the normalization deal between Jerusalem and Abu Dhabi, as well as Gaza, stealth fighter jets, spyware, the coronavirus, and inevitably, elections. And with such a wide range of topics on the agenda, that can only mean one thing. Amos Harel is in the house. Hi, Amos, how are you?
Fine, and you?
Not bad, thank you. I may have mentioned this before, but in addition to being Haaretz's military analyst and at the moment our pandemic stroke national emergency correspondent, you also write about black music. Your article about which song could turn into the anthem for the current Black Lives Matter protests in America was excellent, by the way, as was the accompanying playlist. I'm going to resist the temptation to start today's episode with a discussion about the merits of Cardi B's latest single, WAP, partly because I'm not sure if it has any merits and partly because this is a family show. So let's pretend instead that WAP stands for What About Palestine and start our discussion with the Gaza Strip. Past week has seen both sides, Israel and Hamas, apparently inching closer to the resumption of hostilities. Israel's been bombing Hamas targets in Gaza in response to incendiary balloons and occasional rocket fire. What's going on, Amos?
It may not be as serious as you've described it. Of course, quite a lot has been going on. The escalation is quite frightening, especially if you're either a Gaza Strip resident or happen to live on the other side of the border, on the Israeli side. But other than that, I still think that both sides are not interested in a full-scale conflict. I would assume that this is Hamas's way of telling us that they need urgent action from both Israel and Qatar. During the spring months and the beginning of the summer, Hamas, like everybody else, was entangled in the COVID mess and was fearful of the pandemic hitting Gaza Strip in a major way. This hasn't really happened because of the siege, because they can control the Strip and they can prevent people carrying the virus from coming in without being quarantined. Actually, it never hit them that hard. Mm. Right now, after 6 months of the pandemic going on, Hamas is still stuck with the original problems that the Strip suffers from. And it wants more money. And the way to do that for them, apparently, is the usual way. Threaten Israel, start fires using balloons and explosives along the border, and finally either launch rockets themselves or allow smaller Palestinian factions to shoot their rockets. And this is what actually happened during the last few days. And of course, the IDF spokesperson every few days or every few hours tells us that the Air Force hit back Hamas targets or tanks shot at the Hamas outposts and so on. But if you look at one thing in particular, which is the number of people getting hurt, you can see that both sides are actually going through the motions. Nobody was hit in a serious wave, as far as I can remember. And what this tells me is that there's still a long way to go for a serious escalation. I think that both sides are sending messages that they're not interested in a full-scale military conflict the way we've seen what we've encountered in the past, whether it was 2014 or in some shorter cases in 2018, 2019. I don't think that that's the case right now yet.
And the shuttered power station in Gaza, that's presumably adding to the frustration of the people of Gaza.
Yeah, of course. During the spring months and so on, electricity was quite available in Gaza. Israel, because of those rockets, because of those fires, began using that sort of punishment against the power station. It stopped allowing Gaza fishermen to go fish in, near the Gaza coast and so on. So it's applying pressure of its own. And I think that Hamas is under a lot of pressure because of that situation. There are also political internal reasons inside Hamas. There are supposed to be elections for the leader of Hamas by November. This is always a tense time for the movement. But then again, although the situation is, of course, tense, and although people on both sides of the border are afraid that this could quickly escalate, I think that there are enough ways and means to stop this. And this is mostly about the Qataris. I think the Qatari envoy is supposed to reach Gaza by Tuesday or Wednesday. He's supposed to come with some money. Hamas is expecting more. They want more millions of dollars every month. We'll see how this plays out. But there's still some time to prevent a full-scale escalation.
He's supposed to be arriving. Will he arrive with suitcases full of money again?
As usual, yeah. This is this is quite common here, as you know, for the last 2 years. And oh, it's quite surprising, I think, especially if you're listening to us and you do not live in Israel, to realize that Israel's right-wing government, not the first one, but Netanyahu has been leading those governments for years. And since, I think, mid-2018, this is actually Israel, which is allowing Qatar to pay Hamas money in order for Hamas not to launch rockets into Israel. It's sort of a protection racket, if you like. But this goes on while Netanyahu speaks publicly in a very hawkish and threatening way towards Hamas, but he's actually turning a blind eye and allowing the Qataris to keep providing this service to Hamas. And actually, he's sending his envoys to the Gulf time after time in order to make sure that the Qataris actually come up with the money.
Should the normalization agreement with the United Arab Emirates also help reach an agreement with Hamas, or are these two different tracks entirely?
No, I think that in the upcoming weeks, the UAE is not part of the issue. The UAE deal makes the Palestinian Authority very, very angry because Chairman Abbas feels that the Gulf states have deserted him. Hamas probably feels slightly different about that, and I'm not sure that the Emirates would immediately start to compete with Qatar on spending money in Gaza. This may happen in the long run. Right now, it's about UAE and Israel relationship on the one hand and Qatar and Hamas on the other.
Amos, is there any military element at all to the UAE deal, or is it 100% political, diplomatic, and economic?
No, I think there's quite a military aspect for that. I think that there have been reports in international media for years about Israeli companies supplying the UAE all kinds of products, whether it's things that have to do with cyber warfare, with technology, with border control, and so on. I would assume that the Emiratis would be interested in more products along these lines, and I would think that it would be easier for Israeli companies to provide them with this once the agreement is out and once there's full normalization between the two countries.
Even without full normalization, though, as Chaim Levinson reported this morning, NSO, the Israeli manufacturer of spyware, has been selling its products to the UAE and other Gulf states, and Jerusalem has been encouraging and even mediating in some cases. And
yes,
you'd say this has been going on anyway, and the deal won't make any difference.
Chaim and myself and Yaniv Kubovich, we broke a story 2 years ago about NSO's involvement in the Gulf state. This is a new aspect of the same kind of relationship. And now, of course, I think it's easier to discuss now after the agreement. But there's a deep Israeli involvement in everything that has to do with cyber in different Gulf states. The fact that it is now out of the closet, if you'd like, will probably make it easier for more companies to get involved. But I think the other aspect, of course, is the American-Emirati relationship.
Right.
And what Netanyahu has to do with that, especially when we talk about the possible weapons deal that would include both drones and the F-35 fighter jet.
Right, that's been quite a bone of attention. President Trump even was asked about it at a briefing last week. He said the UAE has the money and they would like to buy F-35s. We'll see what happens. It's under review. But Netanyahu denied that the sale of F-35 was an integral part of the normalization deal, right?
I have to say, Simon, I found it quite funny the way things evolved. Because if you remember, last week our colleague Nahum Barnea from Yediot Ahronot published a story saying that this was the missing link or the missing part of the jigsaw puzzle, and that there was, in fact, and that the United States and the Emiratis were approaching an agreement which would allow selling F-35 planes to the UAE. What Barnea hinted was that Netanyahu has actually given his green light to Trump. Netanyahu, of course, denied that completely, accused Barnea of publishing fake news, and so on. But then came the president's press conference after a day or two, and the president actually said that quite bluntly and openly, that there were negotiations, in fact, going on. Mm. Now, in order to understand what's going on behind the scenes, we should go back to the concept of QME, which is qualitative military edge.
Right.
It goes back to the Johnson and Nixon administrations. Later on, it became a law, a series of laws that were passed in the American Congress. And it actually maintains that American presidents should consult Israeli administrations before approving weapons deals to countries in the Middle East, which could endanger Israel's qualitative military edge over its neighbors. So Trump doesn't need a green light from Netanyahu. All he has to do is tell Netanyahu that he's about to sign such a deal. Netanyahu apparently would complain, and then Trump would say, okay, tough luck, but we need the money right now. We need jobs. We need Lockheed Martin on our side, whatever, and allow such a deal to go through.
Mm. Would Netanyahu's complaints just be lip service? Does he mind? Israel mind?
Israel minds up to a point. It's quite clear that the professional level, whether it's the Israeli Air Force or the Israeli intelligence community, is concerned not about the immediate outcome, but about a possibility which somewhere in the long run there would be a change of regime in the Emirates, or that this would pave the way for more deals with other countries such as Egypt, or Saudi Arabia, or whatever. So Netanyahu, on the one hand, he's saying, no, I'm against this, and so on. On the other, it's implied that this is not the worst thing in the world. This may be true, but the problem is that the Israeli public was not told the truth about that. When Netanyahu denied in such words and started fighting with Yediot Ahronot over the story, I think the average Israeli, if he was at all interested, would have assumed that, yes, this was the truth. The prime minister was speaking the whole truth. This was the case. He's against it, and nothing is going to happen. And then you listen to Trump 2 days later, and you understand that Netanyahu was busy denying something that wasn't even claimed. If you remember the Watergate scandal, this is what we call a non-denial denial. Mm. He says something that he denies something that he was not exactly accused of, and it doesn't mean that this is the actual case right now. Israel apparently Trump doesn't need Israel's okay. So okay, Netanyahu can say that this is against his will, that this is dangerous. Trump would say differently, and the deal would go ahead. I don't think that's the end of the world. It's not a direct, immediate threat to Israel, but I do think that the Israeli public should know all the details when such a deal is presented. I think that the actual normalization agreement with the Emirates is quite a feat for Netanyahu. Strategically, it's a good thing for Israel. When you talk of our military balance against Iran, when you talk about our relationship with the Palestinians and so on, but I think we need to know the full details. And the fact that Netanyahu attacked the newspaper so aggressively, in my view, shows that he actually had something to hide, and it was Trump that told us, who told us the truth this time. Quite surprisingly, but that was the case.
Yeah. Methinks the Prime Minister doth protest too much. The same happened with the annexation, right? He claimed that it was still on the table, and very quickly the administration came back and said, no, 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 no.
Exactly, and there were also shades of the submarine affair, if you remember, a few years back. Part of the submarine affair, part of the scandal that has angered so many ex-generals, was the fact that we found out in retrospect that Netanyahu secretly gave Chancellor Merkel the go-ahead to sell strategic submarines to Egypt. Netanyahu denied that for months and months until during one of the election campaigns he was actually caught on camera, on mic, more or less admitting that he did that, saying that there was some kind of secret and so on. So we're having a rerun of the same case. Mm. A secret having to do with strategic balances, a sort of an okay which is given either by turning a blind eye or reaching actual agreements behind the scenes, and the sole truth which is kept from the Israeli public. It's troubling. And the fact that there's a pattern here is something that I think Israelis should be concerned about.
And you say there's a pattern, and this also comes to play in the domestic political angle, how Bibi used the issue to further sideline and marginalize Defense Minister Benny Gantz, right? I mean, he's marginalizing everyone, micromanaging every aspect of his government's policies, from peace deals to the corona response. So nothing new there, right?
That's true, and I think Gantz should mainly blame himself for the fact that he was so naive in entering this government. I think it was April when the agreement was reached, and he actually believed that this was a crisis government, a national unity government that was meant to deal with corona. Look, by now we know where we stand, and I think neither Gantz or Ashkenazi should be surprised by any maneuver that Netanyahu was doing. I think he's way ahead, miles ahead of the competition when it comes to political understanding, when it comes to strategic understanding. And he's, of course, willing to do almost everything in order to have the upper hand. So it's not even a fair fight, if you'd like. But I think the right perspective of looking at what's going on right now is understanding that there's one main goal for Netanyahu and possibly the only goal for him, which is getting out alive from the Jerusalem court. Once he was indicted for three different cases of corruption, this is the only thing that matters. And I think that for him, it's a fight that's fought by any means necessary. And he will be willing to do almost everything in order to avoid jail time. And his political rivals should be perfectly aware of that, because this is what's dictating everything else that's happening.
I guess that leads us on to the biggest question of the day, or the next 48 hours, at least for Israelis and for journalists, Amos. Could Netanyahu include having another election as part of his ploy to postpone or delay or get out of a trial?
Look, Simon, I wouldn't dare bet. I think that all options are probably on the table, and you have much better experts such as Chaim Levinson or Yossi Verza to discuss political matters. It's quite clear that this government is not going to reach 4.5 years of a term. One thing I would bet is that Benny Gantz would not become the actual prime minister under these circumstances. Despite the agreement, yeah. Of course. Whether this happens by November, if Netanyahu goes for an early election, or by sometime next spring, it has yet to be decided. A lot has to do with the internal maneuvers inside the Netanyahu family. He has only one vote out of three, we're told, regarding this. We'll probably know.
The other votes belonging to?
To the wife and the son.
Right.
But other than that, we'll probably have to wait and see. But I wouldn't bet on this government maintaining power for in the long run. We'd probably either go to elections in November or perhaps more likely sometime next spring, but this would happen quite soon.
Okay, while you've got your crystal ball out, Amos, can you just have a quick look and tell us whether we're going back into lockdown for the Jewish High Holy Days, which are now less than a month away?
It's hard to say yet. I think that there's a sort of taboo around a full-scale lockdown because so many people were hurt badly during the previous one, during March and April. And I think that because of the financial situation, because it was mentally so hard for people, the government would have a hard time reaching such a decision, saying full lockdown for 3 or 4 weeks and so on. there might be something at Rosh Hashanah and then again at Yom Kippur telling us, you know, not to invite grandparents and so on. There might be some limits on movement. But the more experts I speak to, the more I hear people resenting that kind of idea and saying it's not that urgent, it's not the right thing to do. And some will tell you this is not even the right path to begin with, that there's no proof that this actually saves lives in the long run. And when it's only about flattening the curve, then maybe other means to be taken. So I don't think a decision has been made yet. And I think the government should be fully aware of the possibility that a lot of Israeli people would actually ignore such an order if it comes. Even if it becomes a law, even if you may be fined for leaving your home or so on, I think many in the Israeli public have reached a point where they completely mistrust the government, both the government's good intentions and its instincts regarding decisions about lockdown. And I think that they would be facing a huge amount of civil disobedience if they try something like this again. So it hasn't been decided yet. There will probably be some limitations. I'm not sure that it would actually reach a full-scale lockdown like what we've experienced during the spring.
And if the protests that we've seen in Jerusalem and elsewhere every Saturday night are any indication, then the civil disobedience, civil unrest is just fermenting and growing week by week.
Yes, up to a point. I would warn both of us from paying too much attention to our Twitter feeds. In the end, these are journalists, mostly people, especially ours journalists, people with certain political views and so on. And it's very easy to get tempted by this and say, okay, this is the worst thing to have happened. The violence is terrible. This is very, very clear. The public is against Netanyahu and so on. In the end, it's quite inspiring to see those people actually going there every week and so on and demonstrating every week. But we have to remember that it is still a small percentage of the Israeli public. We haven't seen yet tens of thousands of people who voted Likud and Netanyahu, for instance, saying enough is enough, our financial situation is terrible, this is the government's fault, and therefore we're going out in the streets demanding its resignation. We haven't arrived at such a point yet. Perhaps if things continue to deteriorate financially, and if the government, people will have problems paying their bills, and people will have an increasing difficulty in finding work and so on, we may reach that point. I don't think we're there yet. I think that this is quite amazing to see how many people actually arrive. But in my view, this is only my personal perspective, I think there's still a lot needs to happen in order for sort of a public movement which would push Netanyahu out. We're not there yet.
It's bad, but it's not bad enough yet.
The current situation, I think that many people are extremely worried, of course, but we haven't reached the bottom of the barrel yet.
Amos, many thanks, as always, for your time.
Thank you, Simon.
Thank you too to our producer, Aaron Ehrlich, and to you, listener. We'll be back again next week with another episode of Haaretz Weekly. Until then, shalom from Tel Aviv.